looking up, but there's another rocky road. Another heavy wow, another much too heavy, heavy load. Today I'm gonna face it, yeah, cause I'm sick of dealing any other way. Nobody said the race was fair, but I'm gonna keep running just the same. Cause today, today, the first day, the rest of my life. Let's go.
Live from Dankosky Vineyards on Syrupy Asylum Hill, I'm Kyone Wolf, and I'm getting, oh, a Vegas soupçon of asparagus and just a flutter of nutty Edam cheese. And that's just the drinking water here. You should try the wine. The Dankosky Blueberry Camphor Merlot has a certain je ne sais quoi. Can a wine taste like nougat? Fortunately for you, we have other Connecticut winemakers here with much more delicious offerings. And now he still has a case of 72 Ripple in his cellar, Colin McEnroe.
Have you ever bought a bottle of Connecticut wine?
Yes, I thought it was good.
I liked it. Stonington Vineyards, yes, yes.
I don't know. I don't think they know enough about it.
It's good wine, but you've got to see it in the package store, and you've got to take a shot at it.
I'm not sure that people know enough about Connecticut wines to give it a lot of thought.
I think people tend to think that it's not going to be as good as maybe, you know, some of the South American or the European wines, but, you know, it's not really pushed. You don't see a lot of it around.
I would like to try more, but the availability is sometimes a bit difficult. We live near one of the Connecticut wine trails. I would really like to get to know more Connecticut wines.
And that's Action Jackson, one of our many outstanding interns out there in the field collecting a little bit of voices about Connecticut wine. Connecticut wine, first of all, I don't think the industry or the growing of wine grapes in Connecticut is much older than the 1970s. And maybe somebody in the room here is going to correct me, because we have a lot of winemakers and wine experts here. There'll be others calling in. We also do want to hear from you. As was heard earlier in the introduction, in the 1980s got really interested in Connecticut wine, but there weren't that many Connecticut wines to get interested in the 1980s. From what I can tell, there's really been kind of an explosion of vineyards, a lot more vineyards and a lot different grapes. You're going to meet all kinds of people as we go along here today, but let's start out with introducing you to Bob Harold, a winemaker and sommelier, and he is associated with M&M Wine Grapes here in Hartford, and he teaches winemaking at Naugatuck Community College and does many other things besides, but maybe you can just sort of put us in the jackpot here. How old an industry, to the best of your knowledge, is the wine industry in Connecticut?
Well, I think you're right. It goes back to the 70s. If I remember, it was Sherman Haight was the first licensee.
Yeah.
That's right.
He helped to craft the farm winery legislation that makes it possible.
And since that time, I think there must be close to 25, 30 commercial wineries in the state right now.
And
growing.
I should introduce everybody, because Howard Burson just chimed in here. He's a winemaker from Sharp Hill Vineyards in Pomfret, Connecticut. Jeff Vernon is with us. He's a winemaker from Chamard Vineyards in Clinton. And also Ralph Gorman, a winemaker from White Silo Farm and Winery in Sherman, Connecticut. So what I remember from the 70s and 80s is that there weren't that many grapes that people were brave enough to grow here in Connecticut. Obviously, we don't have a long growing season, and there's a lot of other factors too. And so people tended to plant these very hardy grapes like Saval and Vidal and stuff like that. And then suddenly, and I'm pretty sure, and this probably points to the importance of getting restaurants to serve your wines. I'm pretty sure I was at Al Forno restaurant in Old Saybrook, and Bob Zemel came over and he said, "You got to try this Chardonnay from Chamard." So, and I'm thinking, you know, I don't really think about Chardonnay in Connecticut, but Jeff Vernon, tell us a little bit about what it is like to produce Chardonnay here.
Chardonnay grows well here in Connecticut. Our growing season parallels places, you know, in France that have done it really well for centuries. And we're one of the vineyards that have been growing vinifera grapes in Connecticut since the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really what we're known for here in the state is our old world style Chardonnay and vinifera style varieties.
And Howard Burson, does Sharp, do you do a Chardonnay?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, the first one we made, which was in 95, took a pretty high medal at two competitions, and we had the pleasure of seeing it beat out five of Robert Mondavi's Chardonnays.
But and what about that idea that, I mean, you know, the Connecticut, you know, it's a short growing season, and the whole idea is grapes have to ripen. I mean, that's sort of the – so there is enough time for a Chardonnay. Is it a special hybrid or version of the Chardonnay grape?
No,
or?
We use the classic clones that come from Burgundy.
Yeah.
And, in fact, we usually get more summer heat than Burgundy.
Yeah.
And the key is you've got to pick the spot. You can't grow Chardonnay just any old place in – Connecticut.
Yeah.
You've got to have some sort of ace in the hole that makes it a superior spot.
Yeah.
I think that's probably true of all vinifera varieties. You have to be very site-specific as to where you could plant them. At my vineyard, for example, they don't work at all, so I'm stuck with hybrids.
Yeah. There's a wonderful French word, which I'm probably about to mispronounce, terroir, right?
Ooh.
And terroir is kind of the interaction of the vine with everything else that's there, your soil, your wind, your overall climate, everything, right? And that's sort of what makes a grape from a certain place a grape from a certain place.
It's true.
Yeah, that's right. And the heating, cooling, soil temperatures, all of those things are big factors into how the wine tastes. That's why there are a lot of similarities between wine in Connecticut, also some differences. Obviously, the winemaking piece is an element of that. Mm. But, you know, we do have more heat. We also have more cooling. But in some ways, you know, we have a shorter season with winter coming on us and all of those things factor in and in our terroir.
You know, the other thing is we've been talking grapes, but not everything that's called wine is made out of grapes. And I think it's time to add Ralph here to this conversation. Ralph Gorman is from White Silo Farm.
Well, we also grow grapes.
You grow grapes, yeah.
Well, but our specialty are fruit wines.
Yeah.
So we have some table wines that are quite dry. People think of fruit wines as being sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Ours, some of them might be too dry.
Mm-hmm.
We make a very nice rhubarb wine, mm-hmm. believe it or not. People will mistake for a Pinot Grigio.
Now, explain how you got into this, because you were originally a fruit farmer with no particular idea of making
no,
wine.
No, I never had any idea that I'd ever make wine, but I got a call from Cornell University. They said that they were helping small fruit farmers, of which I was one, set up wineries. So they gave me a recipe for rhubarb wine. I made it, gave out 50 bottles, screw top, very cloudy, no filtration, nothing. But the taste was quite good.
Mm-hmm.
So I called them back and I asked their advice, what does it take to make a winery? The ones that I've looked at, like the big wineries, looked like they cost millions. But they said, no, just get yourself some food-grade plastic containers, a pump, a hydrometer, mm-hmm. a couple of little things, and you'll be in business. And the following year, I was in business.
Well, and that's the thing, yeah. Where you, I heard somebody else's voice pipe up. That you know, the, years and years ago, I remember helping Hubelein and somebody else judge a homemade wine contest at the New Britain Italian Festival, and we drank some pretty strange things that day, and I was very happy to be alive the next day. But it reminded me, Bob Harold, that the idea of, I mean, making wine can be an incredibly small operation. I think some of your experiences this goes back to Queens, right?
Yes. Yeah. I started when I was 12 years old in Queens. We had an Italian neighbor who made wine the old-fashioned way, if you want to call it that. But all they did basically crush, de-stem, press the grapes, and then kept their fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm.
The wine was fantastic within the first couple of weeks. By the time Christmas came, I noticed that there was a deterioration. By Easter, you couldn't drink the stuff. However, they thought it was great, and they drank the whole thing. And that's the traditional way of making wine. Hopefully, most of us here do things a little bit different.
Yeah. Actually, I remember that day in New Britain. We did wind up finding one, you know, pretty decent kind of Chianti-ish kind of thing that was, you know, you wouldn't object to at all if somebody served it to you in a restaurant. Well, as long as we're telling stories, let's hear everybody else's story. Howard Burson, how did you come to be a winemaker? And were you doing something else before that?
Yeah, I was actually teaching philosophy.
Okay. At UConn or where?
No, at Wells College in central New York State.
Yeah. And then how did the transition happen? How are you now a winemaker?
Well, I had been making wine at home while I was getting my degree in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, either I'm going to be a philosophy professor or a winemaker.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a job while I was writing my dissertation. I took a job at Walter Taylor's Bully Hill Winery in Hammondsport, New York. Yeah. And I worked there for a couple of years. And by the time I got done there, I knew I was hooked.
Hmm. And is how old is Sharp Hill? How long has Sharp Hill been around?
We planted our first grapes in 92, mm-hmm. and we built the winery building and were up and running by 96.
Because there was in Pomfret years ago something called Hamlet Hill, right? And that's gone now. Are you in their place? Are you in the
no,
same
it's
location?
Not. It's a totally different place, and actually I designed both wineries.
Oh. Hmm. And so, lastly, you're going to meet somebody else from Chamard in one of the other segments we do here today. But Jeff Vernon, how did you come to be a winemaker?
I grew up farming grapes in Western New York, and then went to school. And halfway through school, decided that I wanted to go back and work on the farm that I hated my whole life. So after school, I went to Cornell and went back, farmed grapes, went a little different path for about 10 years, and found Chamard, and really happy.
So we also invite you to call in if you're listening, if you have questions, if you have comments, if you have wines that you've tried or things you want to know about. We've got the experts here, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Our call screener today is Captain John Walcott Holt IV, and he would be very happy to handle your call in a very distinguished way. 860-275-7266. You can also tweet us at WNPRColin. So I'll ask all of you the question. I mean, let's imagine that somebody is out there listening and they're thinking, you know, I've always kind of wanted to do that too, and I've got a little bit of land here, and you know, maybe I'll be a winemaker. What words of caution or words of inspiration would you give them? Since we just ended with you, Jeff Vernon, I'll start with you and work around. What would you tell somebody?
It's a passion that is terrific to pursue, and it's an awful lot of fun. It also has a terrific amount of challenges that come with it, especially for a home grower, and depending on what kind of grapes they want to grow. If they want to grow vinifera, there's a lot of expertise and a lot of specialized equipment. I was speaking with somebody on the phone the other day that was having some trouble at their small grapes that they had planted, and having access to chemicals that cost, you know, $500 a quart, and they need an ounce is, you know, it's kind of hard. So there are those kinds of challenges as well, but it can also be very rewarding, and there are a lot of grapes that grow really well here that aren't vinifera that that people, as Bob said, you know, when they drink their own wine, it's delicious. So
when you say the not vinifera, what does that
well
mean?
I mean, they're hybrid varieties. Yeah. I think, I don't know if we touched on them earlier, but Cuga Whites or St. Croix, or those are more notable ones that people have heard of and that are grown a lot in Connecticut with a lot of success. They're a cross between Lambrusca, American varietals, and the French vinifera, and they were developed a lot of it out in New York State, in that sort of Bully Hill, Cornell area, to combat the very cold winter and shorter growing season, and they put a lot of fruit out without nearly as much effort as the vinifera.
Let's go down. Any other words of advice, inspiration?
Yes, start small. Yeah. Start small. I started with 12 vines. That was going to be my entire vineyard. 3, 4, 5 years later, I was up to 500. Mm. So it's an addictive hobby. It's a fantastic hobby. Once you get hooked, you'll be doing this for the rest of your life, and the wines are good. Mm. And so it's just an enjoyable vocation.
More from Howard Burson at Sharp Hill.
Well, I would say that if you're thinking of doing it on a commercial scale, I've got a little land, I've got some retirement savings and so on, I would say don't do it.
Yeah.
Because it's, in terms of a commercial business, it's very capital intensive, and it's a very risky business. It's hard to make money.
Yeah, yeah. And I would imagine also, go ahead, Ralph Gorman.
I somewhat disagree. I think you can start $500 or $1,000 probably. That's how I started. And I started right off as a commercial winery. The license from ATF doesn't cost anything except a little effort. I think what you do is you start small. As your business grows, you buy equipment. Hmm. I mean, I started with just a hand pump that I had to turn crank, and it worked great for 30 gallons. But when we got the 500 gallons, you needed 6 hands in order to do it. But then I bought pumps and stainless steel tanks and labelers and bottlers and whatever else was required.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Jeff Vernon over here. There are other options too for people besides, to your point. I mean, it is very capital intensive, depending on how you're going about it. But there are other options. You can buy grapes from M&M. They have grapes from Chile, from California, from all over the world, from Italy, and make wine in that way. There are people that have programs similar to what we have at Chamart in Connecticut, where you can come in and craft your own barrel of wine and really create it entirely yourself with the supervision of a winemaker so that it doesn't taste, undrinkable by Christmas.
All right. So that's worth noting, that M&M is, you're an importer, right?
Yes.
Bring in grapes from all over the world, and people
all over
can buy
the world,
them and
both,
make whatever kind of wine they want.
Both in the autumn from the West Coast season as well as the Southern Hemisphere from Chile and Argentina and places like that in the springtime. We also have classes, so if anyone's really considering taking or learning anything about making wine, we offer classes at M&M that will take basically one evening. It gives you the basics, and you could then decide whether it's for you or not.
Seems like it's cheating somehow. I mean, you should be like having to trek around on the frosty ground in March and go, oh my God, what's going to happen? We'll take a little break here. We're going to taste some of these wines. I was sort of waiting to do that so that, whatever happens to me as a result of this will be happening towards the end of the show. We're going to taste some of these wines. We would love to hear from you. We have a lot of people calling in already. 860-275-7266.
And Hedy, where's my love?
Let me show you how this is done. Hold the glass up and examine the wine against the light. You're looking for color and clarity. Now, stick your nose in it. There's some strawberry. Oh, there's just a flutter of like a nutty Edam cheese.
When do we drink it?
Now.
Mmm.
Are you chewing gum?
That, of course, is from Sideways, which probably was a consciousness raiser about wine tasting for a lot of people. Paul Giamatti and Thomas Hayden Church, of course, in that.
Just
so
a little bit.
We're here talking about Connecticut wines. Sure. We have Connecticut wines here in the studio. Kion Wolf is pouring them right now. 860-275-7266 if you want to call in and ask us questions or talk to us. And while that's happening, we are going to – Jeff Vernon has transformed himself into Bridget Reardon, also from Chamard.
Nice.
Their Chardonnay is out on the table. So we're just going to all have a little sip of that. Oh, it feels so much like the food schmooze here. I'm sitting here drinking wine on the radio. I feel like Faith Middleton. The coughing is a bad sign.
What happened was my son took this wine class. He says, you just don't just take it down. What you do is you go...
Yeah.
So I did that.
you aspirated the Chardonnay. I really like this a lot. I'm so impressed by the Connecticut Chardonnays that I've had. I was up at the Coventry Farmers Market on Sunday, and there were wine tastings, including.
So was I.
Yeah, I know. I know you were up there. You had such a big line. I never got over to you.
Yeah, I never got. I didn't see daylight.
But Cassidy Hill Vineyard from Coventry was there, and they had a Chardonnay. And I'm assuming that's a pretty small vineyard, but it tasted very much like a Chardonnay and had, I mean, I have this whole theory anyway. Oh, okay, I'm about to turn into a wine jerk here, but I can't help myself. The California Chardonnays, they got all mad at themselves, and they stopped making that big oaky Chardonnay that everybody thought was a California Chardonnay, and they started doing un-oaked Chardonnays, and they started doing stuff. And some of the Connecticut Chardonnays that I've had recently taste more like what I think Chardonnay is than California Chardonnays do. Anyway, Bridget, tell us a little bit about – is there anything you want to say about your Chamard Chardonnay that we're all drinking right now?
Sure. This is our 2004 Estate Reserve Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. This style Chardonnay is really what Chamard has built its reputation on. And it's the style of Chardonnay. It's an old world white Burgundy style Chardonnay that our original owner, Mr. Cheney, really intended to make. Mm-hmm. It ferments first in stainless steel, and then about 60% of the vintage goes out into French oak barrels. Ages about 9 months in French oak, goes through a secondary fermentation, and then is bottled. So this has been in the bottle since September of 2005. And it's really sort of what Chamard Vineyards has been known for, classic old world style Chardonnays.
I'm interested in what Bob Harold has to say about this, since we decided he's a sommelier.
I think, again, it's a classic a Chardonnay. I think it would stand up to any Chardonnay from anywhere in the country.
Mm-hmm.
They've done a great job with this. And
we're about – it's sort of interesting because I'm about to also – give some of my unwarranted opinions here and unqualified opinions on the air. We're drinking the Chamart, and it's pretty close to room temperature, if not room temperature. And as far as I'm concerned, that's kind of fine. That I think, in particular, Chardonnays, people drink them way too cold most of the time. You know, I mean, they probably shouldn't be room temperature, but you know, Chardonnays, I think, kind of, you know, you taste more of them as they're not totally cold. But I'm not the wine guy here. That's my own annoying opinion. We have a lot of people calling in. I want to get to some of these calls here. But should we now do side by side? We should drink some sharp. Have sharp.
Sure.
I would try that. And interesting. The difference between the two pretty apparent. I think there's a little bit more crispness to the Sharp Hill.
Mm-hmm.
The Chamart is a little bit more soft and mellow. Mm-hmm. A little more mellow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I actually like both of them a lot. And boy, when you talk about terroir, there's something I can taste here in the Sharp Hill that's real, real. I think probably is very specific to where you grow it and what it is.
You know, it's true. Mm-hmm. We get a certain kind of a minerality to the mm-hmm. wines. For years, I had read about Chablis having true Chablis having a mineral taste, and I wasn't quite sure what they meant.
Mm-hmm.
But sure enough, our estate Chardonnay. That's the 08, by the way, so that's only been in the bottle for about a year and a few months.
Mm-hmm.
It has a certain quality that I find unique, I must say. I get it every year, too.
I mean, the other thing that we're kind of doing wrong here is just drinking wine without food. Wine is a food, and it needs to go with food. And each one of these Chardonnays probably would go with a different kind of food. You would, you know, I'm not sophisticated enough to figure out what suggestions I would make, but maybe you are. What would you serve your Chamard Chardonnay with?
We've always said that the estate Chardonnay is perfect with lobster, shellfish, and I think part of that is also because we're, you know, 2 miles from the Long Island Sound. We've got a maritime climate. It's creamy, mm-hmm. as you can tell.
Yeah.
You can tell from the color. It's golden, so it will cut the acidity of anything, any shellfish or anything that any dish with citrus in it.
And Howard, what about this? What kind of food would you
take
serve?
Take some cherry stone clams and put them on a half shell. Reserve the juice, and then take some fresh breadcrumbs, a little bit of garlic, oregano, and some good olive oil.
Yeah,
and fry up the breadcrumbs till they just begin to turn color. Pack it on top of the clams. Put them in the hot oven for about 10-15 minutes.
I'm going over to Howard's house.
Wait a minute, can we order that?
Clams oreganata. That's my favorite with this
wine.
That's
good.
I think also this wine, because of the minerality I'm always looking for stuff to serve with pesto. My son and I are pesto freaks, and I make a pretty intense and our pesto to pasta ratio, the pesto part of it is a pretty high. We eat a lot of pesto with the pasta. And then you need something. You know, you need something that can kind of work with that a little bit. And I think this would really go. I often serve a Vermentino with it. Not to him, but this also. This would be really good. You know, it's got the kind of nice kind of balance you're looking for.
Yeah, these are both very food-friendly wines.
Yeah. So Ralph, what are you thinking over there as you taste these two wines?
I think they were both quite good. I like them both.
Yeah, got to get along with everybody.
I'm not a big Chardonnay drinker.
Mm.
I like more Sauvignon Blancs and maybe Pinot Grigios, but I like them both a lot.
All right.
Both very different.
Yeah. Let's get a call on the air here. We've got Danny in Old Seabrook. Hi, Danny.
Hi, thank you.
What's on your mind?
I don't drink, but I think it would be nice if NPR got Guyon Wolf her own show.
Are you sure you haven't been drinking?
Why?
Are you sure you haven't been drinking? All right. Well, anyway, that's that's sort of a non-wine opinion, but it's, you know, it's, this is a guy who
is
that I
your
heard.
Uncle?
Could you hear him? Could you hear
him?
Oh,
I heard him. Yeah, I'm blushing right now. It's either him or the wine.
Yeah. And actually, let's talk to somebody else from another winery who's calling in and probably wishing he were here. Here's Jim Jerram from Jerram Winery. Hi, how are you?
Hello, Colin. I'm well, and I hope you are too.
Well, I mean, we're drinking delicious wine here. What could possibly be wrong? What's not to
nothing.
Like, as they say?
La Dolce El Vita. You know, life is beautiful.
So tell us where your winery is and a little bit about it.
Well, it's in New Hartford, which is about 21 miles northwest of the capital.
Yeah.
And on Town Hill Road, which is historically a significant location. We have 11 acres here, started as a hobby back in 1982, make wine for friends and family. My family size stabilized, but my list of friends was growing exponentially. So when I retired from a different career in the mid-90s, that gave us pause to consider becoming a farm winery, which we did in 1998. And here we are, 12 years later, and we're still planting more vines, making more wine, making more friends, having a good time.
And I'm being told that Coyote and Wolf actually did pass through your winery, which we've turned her loose on the Connecticut wine landscape. I don't know if she identified herself to you or not, but she was there within the last week or two. And so initially, you sort of did you crushed your grapes by hand initially. Do I have that correct?
As a matter of fact, yes, in our cellar with one of my sons. And we outgrew the cellar and moved into a garage, outgrew the garage and moved into one of our outbuildings. And we now do no longer use our feet to crush the grapes.
and you believe, I think you also believe when you're working on this, you got to take a lot of notes. So what kind of notes do you take? What do you try to remember as you're doing this?
Well, that was a major breakthrough back around 1986, 87. Hey, we have to take notes. We have to remember what cultured wine yeast we used with a particular variety, how much, what the acidity is, what the pH is, so that we have a better chance of duplicating our successes and eliminating our failures from years past to become consistent in our wine quality. And that's what happened in 1987, 88, 89. We kept getting more and more consistent. And the reason for that was we started taking notes.
Jim Jerram, I'm just going to put you on hold for a second because you're interfering with my drinking. And we are going to taste something. I think this is from Ralph Gorman at White Silo Farm. Am I correct? Tell us what we've got here, Ralph.
You've got a rhubarb wine that's made from fresh organic rhubarb that we grow. We think we have a leg up on most people because our fruit comes out of the field, and in 10 minutes, it's in the tank. Most people, I don't know how they process their fruits, but we believe in fermenting right on fresh fruit. We do that with our raspberry. We do that with our blackberry. We do that with our currants.
It's got a wonderful aroma to it.
Talk about pesto. It'll stand up to some pesto.
This is the best rhubarb wine I've ever had in my life.
Of course, it's the only one you've ever had.
I'm going to say that. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, in terms of introducing people to Connecticut wine. I mean, there's sort of probably two gateways. One of them is stores where people go to buy wine. So let's talk about stores for a second. In terms of wine shops and stuff like that, how easy or hard is it to get these products right up there next to, you know, Mondavi or whoever? Anyone want to grab that one? Howard?
Well, mostly it's pretty tough because there's so many wines out there. And so one route you can go is to go in and give a tasting to the wine buyer at a given store. And if they like what you're giving them to taste, then they might put up a display to get it started.
Any other people with experiences with stores? Or?
Well, we found that doing the wine tastings were helped us a lot. But you just can't stop there. What happens, you do a wine tasting, then 3 months you have to do another wine tasting. And so it's an ongoing relationship between the person that's delivering and doing the tasting. It has to just go on forever, actually.
Yeah. Any other store comments? Yeah.
I just did a class out of the Brooklyn Botanic Garden about 2 weeks ago on local wines.
Are they growing grapes there?
No. I don't believe they are yet. However, the challenge was finding the local wines to pour, and we were doing, you know, 9 whites and 9 reds, and the biggest part of the job was finding the wines. So it is difficult to find them.
Yeah.
Well, Chamard Vineyard started off really as predominantly a wholesale company. So we did most of our business through partnerships with wine shops and restaurants. Now we really sell more wine from the vineyard. But I have to say that it's probably in the past 7 to 10 years, it's become more and more difficult because we have so many wines from all over the world that are priced really very reasonably. It's difficult to produce wine in relatively small quantities at boutique wineries and then compete by price with some of these wines coming in from South America and, you know, other points around the world. So it's really partnerships mm-hmm. that you build. We still do probably 35% to 40% of our business through wholesale partners. But it's education, constant education. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully having people fall in love with the wine when they visit the winery and then going back to their local mm-hmm. wine shop and requesting it.
I would say just a few things about that, too. One of them being, first of all, if you're a locavore, and I kind of am. I'm somebody, I have like this sickness where I'll go to 4 farmers markets in 4 days. You know, but I mean, if you're a locavore, you believe in sort of eating the stuff that's grown close to you for a whole bunch of different reasons, philosophical reasons, taste reasons, biological reasons, and certainly ecological reasons. I mean, these wines here have kind of a lower carbon footprint. They weren't shipped, you know, thousands of miles to you. So there's sort of that, there's that argument for them. And I think that's an important argument to stress. Another argument, I think, for them is just sort of kind of the fun of local pride. It is sort of fun if you're visiting somebody and you have to take a hostess gift and you're visiting somebody someplace else and, somewhere else in the country, it's really fun to bring a Connecticut wine, and these Connecticut wines have gotten good enough so that they do stand up well. And it's kind of, you can sort of say, hey, this is something from where I live, a nice host or hostess gift. And similarly, it's really fun when people, particularly people who don't believe there could be such a thing as Connecticut wine, are visiting you somewhere. You're having a dinner party, and there's people from New York coming in or wherever. It's, you know, you could even blind board it for them and say, this is some, try this and tell me what you think, and then tell them it's from Connecticut. But I mean, these are all really good arguments, I think, for buying the Connecticut wines. This is our stuff.
It's that same local pride that if you take one step further is making your own wine.
Yeah.
And even growing your own grapes on a non-commercial basis. It's and putting your name on a label, that is a lot. It means a lot to a lot of people.
All right, so we've tasted 2 Chardonnays and a rhubarb wine. I'm actually going to have to lie down and take a nap, and Kion will host the rest of the show here. But before that, we'll talk to Jamie Jones, a winemaker at Jones Family Farm in Shelton. He's the president of the Connecticut Wine Vineyard and Winemaking Association. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I know we must be leaving out all kinds of things as you've been listening to us, but maybe it's time now to mention the Connecticut Wine Trail, which Kion Wolf actually has been riding on recently.
Well, yeah, no, 23 of the state's wineries, farm wineries, all work together to promote each other and encourage people to visit the wineries along the trail. And, of course, the summer and fall season is an ideal time to be doing that.
And there is a thing where you get a passport, right? Talk about the passport.
Well, the passport program, it's a little separate from the wine trail. It's that's actually run by the State of Connecticut's Farm Wine Development Council. And what it is this little blue book that you can be picked up at any of the Connecticut farm wineries. And each winery that you visit, you can get a stamp at it. And once you've visited 16 of the wineries, you will be eligible for a drawing for a trip to Europe. I believe it's next January.
I actually have Kion Wolf's passport here. She's been to Jerem Winery. It's been stamped. He's also written Never Come Here Again next to it. But that might have been just a little incident that they had. And don't we have some kind of a big festival coming up here too as well? Who wants to mention that?
We'll let
Jamie Jones get us into this. Yeah.
Yeah. No, the Connecticut Wine Festival. It's kind of a big celebration that we have on Saturday, July 31st, and Sunday, August 1st. It'll be held at the Goshen Fairgrounds. I believe 15 of the Connecticut farm wineries will be participating in it this year, and it just gives people a great opportunity to go to one spot and really the chance to see 15 of the state's wineries all in one day. I know we are a small state, but despite the geography of where all the wineries are, to visit 15 in one day would be a little difficult. So this festival presents the opportunity for those interested to do that.
You know, Kion Wolf, who clearly has been trying to cheat the entire time, because she asked the same question of the, you know, we have many wonderful wines brought in by our guest here today, and she said, well, can I get my passport stamped? And they said, no, you have to come to the winery. That's the whole idea. And now she wants to know if she can go to this thing and get her passport stamped by all the 15 winemakers are there, and that doesn't seem right either somehow. Right?
Well, no.
I'm asking you to make a ruling right now from your executive office.
Well, we do have, if someone does come to the wine festival, they do get one stamp for visiting
one
wine
stamp.
Festival.
Yeah, but one stamp, exactly. But you can't be getting like five stamps at one wine festival. That doesn't seem right.
Yeah, I think if you open, I think it's one of the first pages in, or somewhere under C, you see the festival stamp page.
So how many of our guests are exhibiting at Goshen this time? You are. Right. You are, yes. Howard Burson is, and Ralph Gorman is. Not Chamard, though. We won't see Chamard. You have to go someplace else to taste the Chamard. It sounds great, though, and I'm glad we're mentioning this. While we're on this topic, I think also it's kind of segues into what I think is the other part of getting people. I mean, you can go on the wine trail, visit the wineries, however you're going to do it. You can look around in the stores to see if there's anything there. They usually have like this tiny little, you know, section of one shelf where it says Connecticut wines. It's kind of like way back, you know, out of the way. But the other way that people discover Connecticut wines is to go to a restaurant. And it's there, and maybe a sommelier or somebody says, you know, hey, you might want to try this. It's actually – so can we talk a little bit about that? How hard is it to get your wine into restaurants? Howard, why don't you begin?
Well, I have to say we've been very lucky. We have people come to us, and our sales now at this point, we're making about 200,000 bottles of wine, and it's really mostly been word of mouth.
I think I'm drinking some of your wine right now. What am I drinking?
That's Sharp Hill Ballet of Angels.
The Ballet of, I love the name anyway. And I know one thing we want to talk a little bit here is about label art and labels as we go along here. But did anybody else want to sort of speak to the whole question of getting wine poured in restaurants, served in restaurants? I know that's how I discovered Chamard. It was because of El Forno.
Yeah, and, you know, I have to say that the number of restaurants that we feel we have really good partnerships with is probably smaller than I would have thought 5 years ago when I started to work with Chamard. But really for us, we feel like a strong partnership, being able to bring the staff of a restaurant in to Chamard and educate them on, you know, who we are, what we do, give them a tour, a tasting, gives them the information they need to go back and then sell the wine. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the sort of the deciding factor, whether or not we can build a relationship and whether or not they can, they have enough information to represent it proudly.
You know, we're going to take a break here, so hold your thoughts. We also are running out of time, and we haven't talked about pouring or labels, or we have not consumed anything red. I love Ballet of Angels, though. I like this Pomfret Terroir, actually.
It's glad you like
all
it.
All kind of interesting things going on with that. Anyway, we also have calls from Glenn and Diava. We will get you guys on the air, too. Just everybody, just hold your fire. We'll be back.
The 93 Nutmeg Blanc, a modest wine, but you'll be amused at its pretensions. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, with designated driving by Captain John Wolcott Holt IV. The part of Bill Curry was played by Thomas Hayden Church. On tomorrow's show, the nose is back to poke into pop culture. And now, back to Colin.
It's back. And everybody behave themselves. They really get into some big side conversations during the breaks here. I do want to run through a few of these calls here, and we actually have moved on to tasting reds, and we'll tell you a little bit about that in just a second. Here's Glenn from Tallinn. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Colin, love your show. Tuned in on my lunch break. Glad that I got to catch the last half an hour of it, and especially right before Mr. Jerem called in. Speaking of red wine, my wife's absolute favorite is Jerem's Nor'easter. This is our third year that we've been doing the Connecticut Wine Trail. Absolutely amazing. Connecticut wines don't get enough credit, I think. I'd love to see them in more restaurants. That would be I'd love to have that option when I go out to eat at local places.
Here, here.
Well, here, here, indeed. I mean, I know there are some restaurants who really kind of maybe if anybody wants to do a shout out to any particular restaurant, I know there's some restaurants that really do make an effort to stock those wines. But you know, another thing I guess Jamie Jones is gone now. One thing I was going to bring up with him, but maybe somebody else here can speak to it or has an opinion about it. For example, on Sunday, I was up at the Coventry Farmers Market, and they did have some wine tasting. And Ralph Gorman was up there with his White Silo Farm winery. We've had some of that wine today, but you can't sell Connecticut wine at a farmer's market. And I know that that's been before the legislature a few times, and you're just not getting anywhere. I mean, it seems like a natural fit somehow.
I think we're making progress.
Yeah.
We're making progress,
but it's slow. Well, I can tell you that there were any number of people that wanted to purchase our wines at the at the Coventry Farmers Market, and we would have sold an enormous amount. But and I think the people there would have been very happy. It would have increased their sales tax for the state. It would have been a win-win. I don't understand. Other states have.
I understand. It's a hangover from Prohibition.
Exactly.
I think it is sort of just one of our many blue laws that kind of just, you know, are still in place. But I mean, there's something innately sensible about this. You're buying a whole lot of other local foods. Wine is a food. You know, it seems like you should be able to do it. Now, the good news is, and this is something I think a lot of people don't know, is that on the flip side of the blue laws is that on Sunday, when you can't buy wine much of anywhere else, you can go to some farms, I think, and buy wine, right?
At the farm wineries.
Yeah.
Right. That's what the legislation was all about.
Mm-hmm. Because I know that, for example, out in the area where I live, Marshall Epstein from Rosedale Farm, who used to be extraordinarily proud of his corn, and I'm sure still is now also very proud of the wine that he makes, and won some kind of award. And you, they make a point of telling you that this is a place where if you were desperate, first of all, if you're that desperate for wine on a Sunday, you may actually need to get in counseling or something. But let's say you're having a dinner and you didn't buy the wine or something, you can go to a place like Rosedale and you could buy a very good bottle of red wine, and problem solved. So that's the upside of all this, anyway. We do want to take a call or two more. It's here's Deava. I hope I'm saying Deava's name right. Deava, yes?
Oh, yes, it's Deava.
Yeah. And tell us about yourself or tell us about your call.
Well, I just wanted to comment, just as a Connecticut resident, how much I enjoy doing the Connecticut Wine Trail each year. It's kind of like my own personal staycation. And I love supporting the local winemakers and participating in the passport program, and I'm still hoping to win the contest one of these years.
Oh, absolutely. And do you have a favorite place or a favorite destination?
Well, actually, my favorite one isn't being represented today. I really enjoy Priam Vineyards in Colchester.
Hmm. There are a lot of places to go. I don't even know what it's called, but I went to the one in Wallingford about a year ago.
Gouveia. That's Gouveia.
Yeah, and that's very nice. And they do a Chardonnay also. That tastes like a Chardonnay. It's really good. We're drinking some reds right now. We also could probably squeeze a phone call or two in here. I want to mention again who all of our guests are. Bob Harold, we've declared him a sommelier. He's also a winemaker, teaches classes in winemaking at Naugatuck Community College, and is with also M&M Wine Grape in Hartford. Ralph Gorman is a winemaker from White Silo Farm and Winery in Sherman, Connecticut. Jeff Vernon is a winemaker, and actually now also Bridget Reardon also with us, from Chamard. Howard Burson is a winemaker from Sharp Hill Vineyards in Pomfret. We're drinking a red right now. We're drinking a Merlot, even though Paul Giamatti doesn't want us to drink Merlots anymore. We're drinking the Chamard Merlot. It's really nice. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to say about it.
Well, I'm glad you like it. We grow, as Jeff said, we grow all vinifera grapes. So we grow predominantly Chardonnay, but we also have Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and Pinot Noir. So both of these wines are a blend, a Bordeaux-style blend of Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Noir, and Cabernet Franc. The first wine that you tasted is a 2002 Merlot. Mm-hmm. Was in American oak about a year and a half, and, of course, in the bottle since 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And this second wine is a Cabernet Sauvignon from 2004. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the points here in drinking these older vintages is that Connecticut wine does stand up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we meet people every day that don't even know that we make wine in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is we make very good wine. We have a great variety of wines. All the vineyards do something a little bit different. And there are some wines that are made in a style that, you can actually put them in the cellar and bring them out 8 years later, and they're better than they were when you cellared them. So,
Howard Burson, I know Sharp Hill does. You do a straight up Cabernet Franc, right?
Yes, we do.
Yeah,
yep. From our own grapes.
Yeah, we should talk a little bit about that grape too, because Cabernet Franc is really kind of the mother of Cabernet Sauvignon.
That is true, and not many people know that.
Yeah,
I'm very impressed.
Cabernet Franc, and I think they've done DNA testing now where they can show that Cabernet Franc and Sauvignon Blanc were basically hybridized, were crossed to make Cabernet Sauvignon.
That's right. Cabernet Sauvignon is only about 500 years old. It's a relative newcomer.
Mm-hmm. But the Cabernet Franc grape, I'm thinking, is a slightly hardier grape, right, Bob?
Yes. That's one of the comments everyone's suggesting is that you could grow it in colder climates like we have here in Connecticut. So it does very well.
Yeah.
And actually, Cabernet Sauvignon is hardy, too, but it ripens just a little bit later.
Yeah.
And it's just a little outside most years. It's outside of our ripening window.
So if you're making wine in Connecticut, do you sort of think of it in terms of your overall mentality. You must be thinking that you're working with narrow margins. It's not a fully temperate climate that's going to – I mean, is it a less forgiving, more – does it have to be a more mistake-free process for you than it would be for even maybe somebody, you know, growing in Oregon or someplace like that?
Yeah, I could speak to that for a moment.
Yeah.
First of all, the quick answer is absolutely. But the thing to bear in mind is that the very best wines in France, for example, come from the more northerly areas which have a real winter. So mm-hmm. Burgundy, for example. And the less esteemed wines come from further south, mm-hmm. where the weather is more like – now, I hate to say this, but the weather is more like California.
Mm-hmm. I think Jeff Vernon has a comment on this. I noticed you switched chairs anyway.
Well, I just wanted to weigh in that, again, it goes back to the cold. And mm-hmm. there is a difference in the cold. You think of a California strawberry and a local strawberry, and the mm-hmm. California strawberry is, you know, gorgeous and beautiful. And in some ways tastes, you know, does not have the bite of a local fresh strawberry that we have here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see that in the wines, the Merlot, the Cab Sauvignon that we have here. A lot of pepper, a lot of spice. Same thing with the Chardonnay. They're bigger. They're different than those that are grown in. You know, I mean, essentially, while it's amazing what they're able to do out in California, I mean, they're growing wines virtually in a desert, and if you know, and they're irrigating, is able so that they're able to make fruit there. And to that end, they have a terrific advantage because they don't have the challenges with cold and the challenges with insects and pests that we have. But the flip side is, to Howard's point, is that they don't have, unless they're growing up in the hills and the more esteemed vineyards, there often are, those that are in colder areas or near to the shore or